The prisons and the detention centers are all managed by the government.
Organ Harvesting Conference gets the Vatican in trouble. It's Thursday, February 9th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We invite you to log in right now to VOA Asia Facebook to get a greater program experience. Also ahead, Thailand professional media and citizen journalists under pressure. An older religion aims for new revival. A Taliban fracture. And the Super Bowl lives up to its name in China. It's kickoff time for VOA Asia. The Vatican is under fire for inviting China to take part in an international conference on organ trafficking that brought together dozens of physicians, law enforcement officials, and representatives from health and non-governmental organizations. Beijing's representative, Dr. Huang Jiafu, insisted that his government has been mending its ways after officially ending the practice of using organs from executed or detained prisoners in transplant procedures announced in 2015. Huang told participants his presence is not to whitewash the past, but to let China's voice be heard and introduce new programs. But rights groups say China continues to lack transparency about its past and present practices. Maya Wong, a Human Rights Watch researcher in Hong Kong, spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty.
The Chinese government is very intransparent about its criminal justice system, particularly about the execution of prisoners. The Chinese government executes many individuals every year, but it doesn't release any figures about how many executes. So there's simply really no way to know whether or not it is sticking with these new crunches. And with Chinese legal system, there have been, you know, in other areas, for example, environmental law, for example, you see kind of positive laws and rules and so on, but the implementation is usually very weak because of the government not letting, for example, civil society to participate in pushing the government to make improvements and so on. It actively punishes human rights offenders who look into these cases. So this makes it very difficult to hold the government accountable to these pledges and make it difficult to believe that these claims are indeed credible. And so for the government to be credible about these pledges, I think the first thing it needs to do is to release statistics about these executions and ultimately end the use of the death penalty in China. These are just initial steps to make its claims credible.
Maya, the colleague of Dr. Huang, Dr. Haibo Wong, stressed that the sheer impossibility of trying to fully control China's transplant activity, since there are some 1 million medical centers and 3 million licensed doctors operating in the country. China's proposing that the World Health Organization form a global task force to help crack down on illicit organ trafficking.
Government, of course, is right to say that, you know, there are a lot of, you know, practitioners and in China, and there's the markets, and it's difficult to fully control the system. I think there is some kind of grain of truth to it. But on the other hand, as we know, the Chinese government can be very effective in carrying out certain policies if it wants to. So it shouldn't be very hard for the government to establish a mechanism of monitoring, licensing, and punishments that are effective. But if we're talking about prisoner organs, the prisons and the detention centers are all managed by the government. So there is really no reason to say that we can't stop the use of prisoner organs in practice by improving monitoring of these facilities.
China insists its organ donation system has been greatly improved and donations have become the only legitimate source of transplants. These are among the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. China seen as key to financial sanctions on North Korea. China tells U.S. it should brush up on South China Sea history. Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank helps Silk Road plan, but may fail to protect China against Trump. Pakistan electoral reform plans aim to boost women's participation in politics. Boom in tourists helping to stabilize China-Vietnam relations. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues with media freedom in Thailand. If you've lived in Thailand for some time or have visited over the years, you likely remember a vibrant media environment with newspapers, radio, and television all streaming a wide variety of thoughts and ideas. Today, it's different. And now, Thai media organizations find themselves battling to halt a media reform bill that they see imposing restrictions on press freedoms, including licensing. So they're pressing the military government to review the legislation. They say it affects the kind of information available to you now in Thailand, and it may affect you personally if you're on social media. Tep Chai Yong, president of the Confederation of Thai Journalists, says some 30 Thai media groups have called on the National Reform Steering Assembly to amend the bill.
The objective is to voice our concern, our opposition to this new media bill that is pending in the Committee on Media Reform of the Reform Council, which we think is quite dangerous in the sense that it would give the power to censor the media to the state.
The draft bill, widely criticized by Thai and English-language mainstream media, covers rights protection, ethical promotion, and standards of media professionals. The bill would replace a system of self-regulation that media organizations say ensure both media responsibility and meeting the public's changing demands. Tep Chai Yong says a controversial aspect of the bill requires media personnel and reporters to be registered, carry a media identity card, all with the threat of losing their registration and heavy fines for ethical breaches.
If they are successful with this legislation, I think this will be the first time that the system of media licensing will be introduced in Thailand. This is something we believe is quite scary because it would subject the media to control of the authorities.
Edgardo Legaspi, director of the Southeast Asian Press Alliance, says the tighter media controls are similar to laws in Singapore and Malaysia, and it marks a major step back for Thai media.
If pushed, the media reform bill may actually result in the ability to control who gets to publish newspapers or who gets to report news or not, like a 40-plus year leap backward.
Pianach Kosat, Thai representative for Amnesty International, says Thailand, as a signatory to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, has to uphold international standards.
We're trying to understand the purpose of these reforms, right? Basically, the reform is just to control the media. The content of this draft bill, which is, I understand that currently this is the final stage. Our concern is to ensure that any bills that they are going to pass it have to be under the standards of the ICCPR or the international human rights law.
Arthrit Suryawankul from the Thai Netizen Network says the laws may also have wider implications for bloggers and citizen reporters.
There's a possibility that it could be extended to netizens and citizen reporters or bloggers or users in general as well. And I think that's very worrying because, yes, we agree that there are blogs that are probably no longer considered as citizen reporters.
Thai Broadcast Journalists Association President Tep Chai Yong is not optimistic a future civilian government would overturn the tighter media controls.
I think this is exactly what the politicians would love to have. I think and the junta is putting this in a silver platter for the politicians waiting in the wings to return to power.
The New York-based Human Rights Watch says since 2014 under the military, Thai authorities have charged at least 68 persons with lèse majesté, largely for posting or sharing comments online. Tell us what you think online by logging on to our VOA Asia Facebook page. Happening now in Asia, Myanmar's government says it takes UN reports of abuses against Rohingya by its security forces seriously, but needs firm evidence before it investigates the claims. The UN warned events in Rakhine State could be a precursor of other egregious international crimes. This story and more on Steve Miller's Asia in a Minute, seen daily on VOA Asia Facebook. We're so glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim country, but as reporter Krithika Varagor tells VOA Asia's Steve Miller, a stricter religious following of Salafi theology based in another country is trying to expand in Indonesia.
Khilaf in Arabic means forebearer, and Khilafism is a puritanical sect of Sunni Islam that advocates for a return to the early Islam of medieval times, around the time of the Prophet Muhammad. In practice, that means it's a very strict traditional puritanical interpretation of Islam that prohibits everything from dancing to listening to music to intermingling of men and women to visiting tombs. And it also considers rival Islamic sects, such as Shiites, as blasphemers.
What is the origin of Salafism, and I guess how far spread is it?
It arose in the Arabian desert. The modern Saudi Arabian state is built on Salafi foundations because in the 18th century, a prominent Salafi preacher named Muhammad ibn al-Wahhab made a pact with a Saudi emir that they would basically protect each other. So during the course of the 20th century, Salafism has become the tentpole of the Saudi Arabian state. And their foreign policy, to some extent, involves spreading that ideology as far as possible.
And how do they spread those tenets of Salafism abroad, especially in Indonesia?
In Indonesia, which is the world's most populous Muslim country, it's a really attractive base of citizens, 259 potential Salafi sympathizers, and they do it through a variety of soft power exercises. Indonesia is a developing country. A lot of people here are poor. Saudi Arabia, particularly, the royal family is extremely wealthy and has a lot of disposable cash to spread it here. So they do everything from providing scholarships for Indonesian students to study in Saudi Arabia. They have built an all-expenses-paid university in Jakarta, among which there is a required subject of Salafi theology.
Now, in part of your article, you spoke with a student who was going to one of these institutions, Ulil Abshar Abdullah. What exactly was his story?
He went to the Saudi-funded university in Jakarta in the 1990s. He was from a small town in Central Java. He was a poor kid, and he said the full scholarship that was provided to him by this university was irresistible. And it was the only college he could go to. So he went, and he liked studying Arabic there. He was really good at Arabic, but he found the required theology class to be very against the moderate, pluralistic Islam that he grew up with in Central Java. When he finished his undergraduate studies, the university offered him a scholarship to continue in Saudi Arabia, and he said no, because he did not like the ideology that they were pushing.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, since the goal of the movement is to kind of extend Salafism abroad outside of Saudi Arabia. Is that kind of Islam being adopted by more Indonesians?
It's hard to distinguish between causation and correlation, but a number of prominent academics do think that Saudi Arabia has played a part in the fact that Indonesia is becoming more and visibly conservative. In general, there's a consensus that Indonesian citizenry has become more conservative.
Krithika Varagor is our reporter in Indonesia, joining us on the phone. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you.
I'm Nilar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
News alert from VOA Asia. After years of investigations and hearings about child sexual abuse within the Australian Catholic Church, the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse says 7% of Australian priests over the past 65 years have been accused of abusing children. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. The United Nations says civilian casualties in Afghanistan rose to a new high in 2016 amid the ongoing Taliban insurgency, with 3,500 killed and close to 8,000 wounded. But new analysis suggests the Taliban is deeply divided, with high levels of dissatisfaction among the rank and file. Henry Ridgewell reports the rift represents an opportunity for what the report calls insurgent peacemaking.
In Kabul and other cities in Afghanistan, a wave of suicide attacks continues to exact a brutal toll. UN Special Representative Tadamichi Yamamoto told reporters Monday that 2016 had seen a record number of casualties.
The killing and maiming of thousands of Afghan civilians is deeply harrowing and largely preventable.
Yet, despite the violence, some analysts say there are opportunities for peace. A study based on dozens of interviews with Taliban insiders suggests exploiting fractures within the group. Professor Theo Farrell of the Royal United Services Institute is co-author of the report.
Senior commanders who were, in a sense, using suicide attacks to build up their reputation. So there are large parts of the Taliban that are fully committed to the fight. But there is a potential here, nonetheless, to de-escalate the conflict.
That potential, according to Farrell, lies in the weakness of the Taliban's leadership.
The new emir, Akhundzada Habibullah, is widely seen as a weak and divisive leader. Many of our interviewees refer to him as simply a symbolic leader. The real power in the Taliban lies elsewhere. And so therefore, there's a view among the rank and file that effectively the movement has become leaderless.
Informal peace talks have taken place between the government and the Taliban leadership, but senior Taliban commanders have demanded the 13,000 NATO-led foreign troops in Afghanistan withdraw before formal talks begin. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Developing at this hour in Asia, gunmen have killed 6 Red Cross workers in northern Afghanistan. The International Committee of the Red Cross says 2 other members are unaccounted for. 3 drivers and 5 field officers were delivering supplies in a remote area. The Taliban denied responsibility. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, snow did not keep hundreds of thousands of fans in Boston from turning out to celebrate the comeback win of the New England Patriots in the American-style football championship game, Super Bowl 51.
They were really symbolizing of how, like, teamwork and leadership and sportsmanship and to never give up in the game.
You know, it's something we can tell our kids down the road, so, you know, it's just great to be a Pats fan.
I'm just so proud of our team and our city. We've overcome a lot in the past few years.
I think that at halftime it felt like the game could have been over, but we had to keep the faith. It was going to be the greatest comeback of all time. Our coach, our quarterback, we knew they were going to win.
The National Football League's Patriots made history in the game, turning a 28-3 halftime deficit into a stunning 34-28 overtime victory against the Atlanta Falcons. New England is the first team to win 5 Super Bowls with the same coach, Bill Belichick, and quarterback Tom Brady. And now, more numbers are in. Over 111 million people worldwide saw the Super Bowl, including in China, as the entertainment website The Beijinger says the championship streamed live for the first time ever in China over Weibo. It was viewed by 7.5 million people. Many checked out Lady Gaga's halftime show, of course, even though football's popularity in China still lags behind soccer and basketball. Mark Gannis runs the consulting firm Sports Corps, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty there's a fascination with American culture in China, especially among young urban Chinese.
And the NFL, in particular the Super Bowl, is the most significant cultural sports type event that we do in the United States every year. It's the quintessential American event on an annual basis. Even things like the Oscars, which before were primarily U.S.-based, now are much more international. So really, the Super Bowl is it, as far as the United States is concerned. And there's a curiosity. Why is it that this is so popular in the United States? Why is it that it is the day that is a de facto national holiday? And so those factors all combine to generating a level of curiosity, if not strong interest.
And the NFL, of course, has a monetary interest in the Chinese market.
They try and sell merchandise. They try and have their games and other events broadcast within China, or at least through internet portals, and to try and generate Chinese market sponsorships and things of that nature. The NBA is far more advanced than the NFL is by a wide, wide margin. And soccer is the most popular sport in China. The NFL has a very, very long way to go to generate a meaningful core constituency of fans and to monetize it in a meaningful way.
Do Chinese actually have teams that play American-style football?
There are some leagues that have been organized to do so, some that are related with some universities. There are a couple of leagues that are people who have enjoyed American-style football and play it. And there's an effort to get more schools and young schools interested in playing it, primarily by getting them involved in flag football, which doesn't have the contact or the equipment that the physical game has.
Could the next logical step be staging a professional game in China?
There's a great deal of effort and discussion about putting a game in China. They're hoping to maybe do something in the 2018 season if all the considerations can be worked out. It's actually quite difficult. The difference in time zones, the ability to, the certainty of being able to broadcast an event out of China, even things like air pollution and air quality are meaningful considerations that make it more of a challenge than it would be in other parts of the world.
Omar Guinness says, like music, sports brings people together, and he reminds us it was in fact table tennis or so-called ping-pong diplomacy in the 1970s that broke the ice between the United States and a then-isolated China. Well, we're glad that we have not been isolated from you and that you had a chance to join us today on VOA Asia. Be sure to check us out on Facebook if you haven't already, at VOA Asia. You may be listening to us on it right now. Also, a shout out to our friends in Burma, Myanmar, listening on the Burmese Facebook page. Thank you. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling, our managing editor Diane Gao, and our great VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned over the recent spike in violence in eastern Ukraine around Avdiivka. Since January 28th, the Special Monitoring Mission of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, has reported a dramatic increase in fighting in eastern Ukraine, including attacks with weapons banned by the Minsk agreements signed in 2014 and 2015. The fighting has caused dozens of Ukrainian military casualties and at least 50 civilian casualties. It has also left approximately 17,000 civilians, including 2,500 children, without water, heat, or electricity. The UN Security Council expressed its grave concern over the dangerous deterioration in eastern Ukraine and called for an immediate return to a ceasefire regime. Security Council members also expressed their full support of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. Nearly 10,000 people, more than half of them civilians, have been killed in Ukraine since the fighting erupted in the spring of 2014, when the Russian military moved to occupy Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Russia's occupation and attempted annexation of Crimea was preceded by months of pro-Western protests in Ukraine's capital of Kiev, which ultimately prompted Ukraine's pro-Russian president to abandon his position and flee the country. In response to Russia's aggression against Ukraine, the United States, the EU, and a number of other countries applied targeted sanctions against Russian individuals, businesses, and officials. These sanctions remain in effect nearly 3 years later. To avert a larger humanitarian crisis, the United States calls for an immediate, sustained ceasefire and full and unfettered access for OSCE monitors. The U.S. also reaffirms its support for full implementation of the Minsk agreements to end the violence in eastern Ukraine and calls for an immediate end to the Russian occupation of Crimea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.